From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Tighe. Today on the program, writer Bill McKibben talks about the formula he thinks will make a difference in fighting climate change.
For me, the important task is to get the 65 or 70% of Americans who know we have a real problem and get some of them actually really active in doing something about it. That's enough to solve this problem.
Auto contributor Mark Savage talks about his likes in the 2014 car models and his dislikes, such as some instrument panels.
I just think that automakers need to ask themselves, what is intuitive and what is simpler for the driver? Because a passenger can always find the right buttons.
And we'll meet Milwaukee's Tom Beal, author of the new short story collection, Badlands. Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much for tuning in today. A year ago tomorrow, a tropical wave in the Atlantic Ocean coalesced, strengthened, and became Tropical Storm Sandy. It became a hurricane 2 days later. By the time it reached the East Coast, it was a post-tropical cyclone, and its effects were enormous. 117 U.S. deaths, mainly in the Northeast, thousands of homes and businesses destroyed, and billions of dollars in damage. It's been widely redubbed Superstorm Sandy. Climatologists say the storm's strength may well have been exacerbated by warming ocean temperatures brought on by climate change. That's not a surprise to Bill McKibben. He is the founder of the environmental group 350.org, which works to affect climate change policy around the world. But McKibben, who started as a staff writer at The New Yorker, describes himself as an unlikely activist. His new memoir, Oil and Honey, details the major transition in his life as he led one part of the fight against the proposed Keystone XL oil pipeline. Bill McKibben joins us in the studio now. Welcome to the show.
Mitch, it's good to be with you, and good to be with you in the middle of the country, not just on the eastern shores of the country.
And in the part that people often think of as flyover country, but you have made plenty of stops in this part of the world.
I was in Wisconsin last winter I wanted to race the Birkebeiner, and they were kind enough to let me give a big talk up in Hayward at the theater the night before, and it couldn't have been a more beautiful day for the race, and it's nice to be back when the ground is free of snow, but I like it best in the winter.
You describe yourself as an unlikely activist and maybe an unlikely person to be the public face of the Keystone XL pipeline fights. Do you think of yourself then as an unlikely memoirist as well?
Yeah. I mean, most writers, there's a certain amount of memoir or a certain amount of writing about what you're doing. But I mean, what's odd for me is the thought that there is more than writing. I've been a writer my whole life, and I thought that was my contribution to this work. I wrote the first book about climate change. But at a certain point, it became clear that writing another book about this stuff was not going to move the needle. We'd won the argument a very long time ago. We just kept losing the fight. So we're going to need to marshal some resources. It wasn't going to be money. The fossil fuel industry has, well, I'm no theologian, but they appear to have more money than God. So we're going to have to find some other currencies to work in. And the only ones we could think of were the currencies of movements, passion, spirit, creativity. Sometimes you got to spend your body, I guess, and go to jail. So that's the kind of thing that people have been doing now these past few years. And though we have not won by any stretch of the imagination, I think we've begun to put up a decent resistance to the most powerful and most rogue industry on the face of the planet, the fossil fuel industry.
Was it your leadership model that you wanted to put on display, or your passion, or something bigger than that, that you might hope would rub off on people from reading this?
I hope that what they get is the story of what an unusual kind of movement this is. This isn't the 60s anymore. We don't have – there's no great charismatic leader, no Dr. King. There's no central obvious organization, the NAACP. There's a very sprawling, spread out resistance to the fossil fuel industry, much of it rooted in local concerns, but able to come together when the questions are national and global. And in an interesting way, it mimics, it mirrors the kind of world, the kind of energy system we want to build. You know, not a few huge power plants, but 10 million solar panels on 10 million rooftops all interconnected. That's the kind of movement it is, and it's exciting to see it. And so I wanted to describe a little bit what it looks like. My role in a certain way has been as a kind of pollinator, as it were, flitting from one place to another and helping kind of spread the message and spread those connections. So maybe it was also fitting that half the book is about our great pollinator, the honeybee, and my neighbor in Vermont, Kirk Webster, who's one of the great apiarists in the country, the first chemical-free apiarist, and really figuring out how to cope with some of the traumas that have beset the gentle honeybee in recent times.
He is in this book for more than metaphorical reasons, and bees are there for more than metaphorical reasons. What do you think that this movement can learn from the way, for lack of a better term, the way bees do business?
Well, I think that non-hierarchical hive operation is kind of what I've been describing as how this movement might work. Bees are pretty amazing. There is a queen bee, but her job is mostly laying eggs, you know. The hive gets done what it's going to get done through a kind of almost unspoken cooperation. And some of it's fascinating. I refer in here to a book that a professor at Cornell wrote a couple of years ago, our leading bee entomologist. And he took on the interesting question of how bees, when they swarm, decide where they're going to relocate to. And it's not that they swarm when there's too many in the hive, and so half the hive leaves and queen goes with them. But the queen does not go off and find some new place. Queen just stays there on the branch surrounded by most of the bees while a few thousand scout bees go off and scout every possible, you know, hollow log and eave and things they can find. And then they come back and in essence they take a vote on where they're going to go, and then they all go there at once. It's a quite remarkable democratic process in a sense, and I'm afraid it demonstrates a fair amount more reason and comprehension of the need for survival than our democracy in Washington does at the moment, where it's, let me tell you, next to impossible to get these jokers to focus on anything that matters, no matter what it is, but definitely anything that has to do with science or standing up to the fossil fuel industry.
Well, and so what do you make of the kind of the dance that President Obama has done around climate change?
It's to be expected because there's only so much he can get done, even if he wanted to, with the Congress that he's got. I mean, the Republican majority in the House doesn't believe in science, man to a man and woman. They keep saying, no, it's not real, it's not, which is crazy. I mean, Republicans used to be in the forefront of the conservation movement. They are no more, in large part because the party's been purchased by people like the Koch brothers, fossil fuel barons. So Obama, you know, is limited in that way. That's why it's so important that in the few places where he is a free throw, he take it and sink it, the Keystone Pipeline being the great example. He could, if he wanted to, deny this permit all by himself without having to ask John Boehner's permission. And that's what we've challenged him now to do. And I don't know how it's going to come out.
Do you ever consider writing off a segment of the population? You write about the hate mail you receive, the profanity-laden vitriolic emails and letters to the editor. And I would imagine most of them are not necessarily from oil company executives. These are just regular people.
No, that's right. So somehow this question, which is just scientific, got caught up in all the ideological mills. I mean, I think it got caught up there because that's where the oil industry wanted it to be, and they paid a lot of money to make sure that there was a lot of disinformation and things. But yeah, I mean, so I don't write people off, but I don't think it's profitable. I don't spend my time trying to convince the last 20% of Americans who are skeptical about this stuff to believe in it. Mother Nature is doing a perfectly good job of that, and at a certain point, everyone, just by looking outside their door, is going to understand the trouble that we're in from climate change. But there are just ideologues who can't, you know, I mean, I think their syllogism goes like this: free markets solve all problems. Free markets are not solving global warming. Therefore, global warming is not a problem. Okay. That's not a very good syllogism, but I can see how it would be emotionally comforting if you'd spent the last 20 years marinating in Rush Limbaugh, you know. For me, the far more important task is to get the 65 or 70% of Americans who know we have a real problem and get some of them actually really active in doing something about it. That's enough to solve this problem. Even 5 or 10% of people truly active would be plenty to win these fights. So that's what we try to do.
This is not preaching to the converted. This is preaching to the complacent, maybe.
Yeah. That's a perfectly good way to put it. And in any rate, preaching to the choir is a useful task anyhow. If you can get the choir singing the same hymn at the same time and singing it loudly, then you have some chance. If the choir has all decided they want to sing random pages of the hymnal, you know, at their own pace, then it's unlikely to lure many people into the church.
Might be my daughter's fourth grade choir.
There you go.
Much of the line of reasoning from the petroleum industry today casts the current situation as an engineering problem with engineering solutions. How do you see that differently?
In fact, the CEO of Exxon used precisely that language, engineering solutions. And someone said to him, "What do you mean by engineering solutions?" And he said, "Oh, well, say we need to move our crop production areas. We can do that. Most people know crop production areas by the name farms. And in fact, we can't just move them. It's true that Exxon has melted the tundra for us, but that doesn't mean you can just take Iowa once it's gotten too hot to grow corn there and transplant it to Siberia. There's no soil. I mean, the corn will fall over. So what we need to do is re-engineer the economics of energy. Our basic problem is the fossil fuel industry is the only industry on Earth that gets to pollute for free. Okay? They can pour that carbon into the atmosphere at no cost. That's why sun and wind and things are so slow to take off. It's not that they're technologically impossible. We know they're not. The one country that's done it half seriously, Germany. And there were days this summer when the Germans generated more than half the power they used from solar panels within their borders. Okay? And this is Germany. My sense of Wisconsin is that there are enough people here of German descent that you could probably, you know, ascertain from them that Germany is not actually a very sunny place, you know. But they have political will to do something about this. There are more solar panels in Bavaria than there are in the United States. Think what a country might do that had, oh, I don't know, Florida, Texas, Nevada, California, Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, Georgia, North Carolina to work with. You know, we might actually really get someplace.
You know, one of the things that many in the climate change movement point out is that these larger and more violent storms are becoming the norm. They're coming with increasing regularity and they are essentially kind of a regular part of the landscape now. Do you worry that as they become the norm, people will think of it as just another storm? That
sure.
Like, was that Irene or was that Sandy?
Right. You know? And there's a sort of deeper thing. I mean, you know, you and I grew up with real winters, and so we recognize when the winters we have don't look anything like that. But if you grew up with what we have now, you might start thinking of it as a new normal. The problem is that though human psyches can kind of adjust in those kind of ways, all our physical systems can't. Corn grows at a certain temperature. When it got as hot as it did in 2012, it was too hot for corn to fertilize. Trillions of kernels of corn across the Midwest went unfertilized. Agronomists tell us that from this point on, each degree increase in global average temperature should cut grain yields about 10%. So the scientists say you're going to raise temperature 3 or 4 degrees. That's 30 or 40% fewer calories on this planet. The federal government spent more money last year recovering from Sandy and from the Midwest drought than the federal government spent on education. that gives you some idea that we're starting to eat the seed corn, you know, and it's going to get a lot worse unless we get a lot smarter fast.
As you think of this work that you do, what makes you happy?
Well, what makes me occasionally optimistic is that the movement is growing fast, and it's a diverse and beautiful one all over the world. 350.org, which I helped found, works in every country on the planet except North Korea. I don't know if we're going to win, but I do know something we didn't know 5 years ago, which is that there's going to be a serious fight.
Occasionally optimistic is not exactly the same thing as happy.
I do my best, Mitch.
And you still, I'm guessing, try to avoid bee stings when at all possible.
I wear my beekeeper's veil with religious. I'm not one of these casual guys who's just out there willing to take a few stings. I'm a coward.
Well, Bill McKibben, I am appreciative that you were not a coward to come into the radio studio and share your time with us.
It was my great pleasure, Mitch. Many thanks.
Bill McKibben is the founder of the environmental organization 350.org and author of Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. He was in Wisconsin this month for a talk at the Oconomowoc Arts Center, sponsored by Books & Company. A short break now, and in just a moment, auto contributor Mark Savage checks in on the 2014 car models from the Corolla to the Corvette. Keep listening. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The 2014 calendar year does not begin for another 2.5 months, but the 2014 car model year has been underway for, well, almost all of 2013. That model year incongruity aside, the coming model year does represent some new trends and the return of some old ones. It also has some updates and some brand new models. Lake Effect auto contributor Mark Savage spoke with Dan Harmon about some of the 2014 highlights, beginning with the new Corvette.
The new Corvette, it's the proof that, you know, power and looks are seductive bedfellows. It's a good-looking car. It still looks like a Corvette, but it looks like a more modern Corvette, and I think that's good. They've been milking the current design for two or three generations now easily, and it was time for some changes. So, it looks more sleek. It looks more modern, a little edgier than Corvettes have been in the past, but at its heart, it's still, you know, this big giant engine. You know, it's got a 6.2-liter V8. Gets about 450 horsepower. They say 0 to 60 in 3.8 seconds. So it is still the muscle car, the performance car, but with a more modern interior. Everybody has been complaining for years that the Corvette is this pricey car with a lousy interior on it. And I think some of that was justified, but it wasn't horrible. I thought it was a very comfortable interior. It just probably had a little more of an old man look to it.
Well, speaking of that, are they trying to shake the midlife crisis image?
I don't know if they're trying to shake that image, but I think like Cadillac, they're trying to bring it down, you know, to the mid-40s level where people might be able to afford it still.
And still have a midlife crisis.
And still have a midlife crisis. But yeah, I don't know. The problem with any nameplate that's been around a long time is that people get used to that and it's hard to change what's already been. And do people want that to be a coupe instead of a real sports car? And I think they've stuck with the sports car end, and I think that's probably a wise move on their part. So, you know, they've got some other goodies in there. They have something they call Drive Mode Select. You can pick 12 different performance settings and different things you can adjust on it. I think that's probably what's needed at a $60,000-plus car. To make people feel justified in paying that price. I doubt you'll use more than two of those settings ever unless you're taking it out on a racetrack. But okay. It's a good-looking car, and I haven't driven it yet. I can't wait, but—
Make sure you stop by.
I will keep you on my list.
All right. All right, so we're talking about 2014 models, and some of it is carryover, and there's actually quite a bit of new designs coming on the scene.
Right. There are a whole lot of things, and everything from, like Cadillac has their new CTS coming out, which is another very edgy-looking vehicle. I think Cadillac's done a nice job of transforming their looks and so forth. This is what they would call their 5 Series fighter for BMW. It's that midsize car that, a lot of people want to buy and get into if you're, a luxury and performance car buyer. And Cadillac with CTS, amongst others, has been pushing that performance envelope with bigger engines and so forth. The other thing that Cadillac has is the ELR coming out, which is the Volt makeover to make it look edgier and like a Cadillac. And so it will be interesting to see if that catches on with the Cadillac crowd. I mean, it's a good-looking car. Again, I think the Volt's a nice-looking car. But again, this is not exactly a hybrid like we think, because it's a car that has a gas engine that powers things, but it basically powers the battery, so you're always working on electric power. So that'll be interesting. I know you and I talked a little earlier, the Corolla, which is one of the bigger selling cars out there.
Yeah, pretty radical redesign for that.
And really a much radical redesign for that, with a kind of a rounded roof line and a more chiseled nose and tail to it. So it gives it – I don't think people are going to look at it and go, oh, just another Corolla. I think they will notice the styling on it. And this is, again, Toyota has been working the last 3 or 4 models that they brought out with a much more stylistic look to them.
And on the interior as well. They've really revamped the dash, so it's not the boring green anymore, the boring orange.
Which anything would be an improvement at this point, I think, because it's been way too long since they've touched that. But I think they also probably wisely learned from Honda when they brought out their Civic and they didn't do too much to make it new, and then had to redo it again within a year to come out with another new version. Because people were dissatisfied you've seen things like the Chevy Cruze come out and the Ford Focus, and they have a more interesting-looking styling and a more interesting-looking dash, and it just feels more modern. I'm sure they had a lot of economies of scale keeping that interior on the Corolla the same for, 18, 20 years, something like that. I mean, yes, they made tweaks, but nothing major. I mean, there were still door handles and window buttons and stuff that look exactly as they did 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, well, if it works.
If it works. I mean, right. There's the if it's not broken, don't fix it. But every once in a while when I spend $15,000, $20,000, I want to get something that looks new.
Although you have an older Toyota.
Yes.
Does it bother you that your car has older technology and features?
I guess it does sometimes. My wife drives our Camry much more than I do, but I get in it, and of course I'm always in new vehicles. But when I get into that, it's like 12 years old now, so it feels pretty old.
It fits like a glove, though.
But it fits like a glove, and it keeps running, and we're well over 100,000 miles now.
All right. Well, just back briefly to luxury cars. I just wanted to ask you about the 2014 Mercedes CLA. Which not only is sort of, well, for Mercedes, quite radical redesign, but to me the most radical part is it's a front-wheel drive car, which to me is shocking.
It is shocking, and I'm not exactly sure what drove that for them, other than there's so many front-wheel drive cars kind of at the lower end of the luxury, market. But it is a departure for them, and they've kind of brought more of their styling that they've had on other cars of recent release to it. So I think it's an interesting looking car. I know you prefer the boxier looks, but this is very aerodynamic. They tell us it's got like the lowest drag coefficient of any sedan out there now. So great for them, and maybe that'll get a little bit better gas mileage and so forth. But styling is in the eye of the beholder, but I like the fact that they're doing something at least a little different with the looks.
Still, though, I mean, what I always liked about Mercedes, or used to, I don't know if he, is that they were simple. The cars were clean, austere, not a lot of creases and curves and junk on it. And the interiors were the same way. They were very well laid out, very simple, very easy on the eyes. But just from what I've seen on this one so far, very curvy, lots of edges. The interior, I think we're back to a lot of buttons, it looks like, for me. So it's
curvy is indefinitely on the exteriors these days. And I think that the problem is that we all want so many features in our cars these days, especially electronics, that the buttons have just gone crazy. And I think I told you, I think the top I've counted was 64 or 5 buttons on a dash of a car, which is just insane to me. So many of them, like BMW, go to the iDrive system where they've got the little knob that you can turn and go through everything. And I think that's – certainly they've made it easier than it used to be, but it is so hard to use something like that while you're driving. You know, at a stoplight, maybe you can tune something in. But the fact that we used to be able to press 6 buttons and get some radio stations, and that was easy, and you could just kind of glance over that way, hit the button, and go. I just had a Lincoln MKZ, very nice driving car. I think it's a pretty good-looking car too. But again, with the touchscreen everything, and some of that they've actually gotten to be easier. But now this one had the volume and the climate controls on a little sliding scale, and you had to hit at the end of a little metal piece on your dash, but you had to hit just above it, and you either hit it and it moved or you didn't. And so you're sitting there constantly trying to fiddle with that thing to get it where you want it to go. And to me, I couldn't tell the difference between the radio and the climate control until after 3 or 4 days. You know, you're just punching buttons and all of a sudden I've turned something on I didn't want to turn on. And I just think that automakers need to ask themselves, what is intuitive and what is simpler for the driver? Because a passenger can always find the right buttons.
Yeah, that's true. You need to bring your own co-pilot.
Yes, you almost always have to have somebody else in the car with you to tune in radio and the climate control systems.
All right. Well, there are two cars I want to talk about together because they're basically the same owner, which are Fiat owns Chrysler and Jeep. So one of them is, again, a pretty radical departure from the previous model, which is they're replacing the Liberty with the Cherokee and making it a unibody, I believe, which, again, is pretty radical.
Yes, it is pretty radical for them, and it's actually a Fiat chassis, again, that they've borrowed to use this for the Cherokee. You know, Cherokee was a big name for Jeep for many years, and that's one reason they're bringing it back. They still have the Grand Cherokee for the luxury end of the market. This one still has the bars in front like a Jeep grill, but I think there's 7 instead of 5. And so Jeep people, I guess, are a little perturbed by that. But I've seen it, and I haven't driven that one yet either, but I've seen it, and it is, I think, a really attractive crossover. Yeah, I don't want to call it a real Jeep or a truck or a Ute or whatever, because I think it's really more of the crossover, again, trying to aim for the family that really wants a station wagon, but the station wagon's too fuddy-duddy, so now we've got to have a crossover. But it's got very narrow, thin lights in the front, a lower hood line, and I think it's a real attractive vehicle. So I'll be interested to see if it drives as well as it looks.
Well, that's my big concern or question is that if you've driven a Jeep Liberty, you sit up high and it feels like a truck and it's just solid. So how can a new design that is not even close to that replicate it? Aren't they going to be offending some people that really want a real Jeep?
You know, they may be, but I think what they realize is the market, most people don't want a real Jeep because they're bouncy and they are square and they're not real comfortable to be in. And if you want to take it off-road, a Wrangler is still available in both two-door and four-door. So I think they've covered that part of the market. If I want a Jeep but I want it to be more upscale, I guess then there is a problem because you're going to have to go to that or the Grand Cherokee to get it. And, you know, four-wheel drive and off-road vehicles are great. But only 2% of the people even buy them take them off-road. So how much do you need it to be that tall and have, you know, 12 inches of ground clearance instead of 8? Not many people do. And most Jeeps ride like a truck, and they are bouncy, and they clop along, and you hit, you know, the rough roads that we have around here, which are pretty horrible most of the time, and you feel like you're driving on the moon. And I think most people like something a little bit smoother than that, and that's – you know, what they go to eventually.
Well, the other part of that is this has been tried with Jeep, with the Compass and the Patriot, and doesn't seem like those did all that well. So are they going to make the same mistake a third time?
They were pretty bad, and I'm hoping that this one definitely has a better transmission. The CVT that was in the Compass and so forth were pretty mediocre. And I'm hoping that they've learned their lesson. I think the fit and finish will probably be at least dramatically better on this. And it does look better. So, you know, will it drive better? Time will tell. They've put some time and effort and money into this. I think they've actually slowed down the launch of this a little bit. So I'm assuming they're trying to get it, you know, adjusted so it is really a nice vehicle when it comes out. So I'm hopeful. And like I say, I'm going on looks only at this point, but I think it will be a very nice vehicle. It just will not be a Jeep Liberty, which also, by the way, got really horrible gas mileage. So I'm guessing this will get much better.
That is very true. All right. Well, the other car in the Fiat Chrysler Jeep family is the 500L, the larger. I'm not even sure I can call it a larger version of the 500 because it looks quite different.
It looks quite different. The 500 is really a mini car to me. The 500L is 27 inches longer, so we're talking darn near 3 feet in my brain. 2.5 feet anyway longer, and so you're going to have more room for people in the back seat. You're going to have more cargo room, and I'm sure the wheelbase has been stretched out a little bit, so it's going to ride a lot better. Although I got to say the 500 was one of the more surprising cars to me for its ride because for that small a car, it actually rode pretty well. This is also, I believe, like 6 inches taller, so you're going to have a lot more headroom, which I know was a problem for some tall folks in the 500. You know, you might like it, but you had to get the convertible version so you could put the roof down and fit your head in there. It's also made in Serbia, which I may be the only car that will be sold in the U.S. that we could say is made in Serbia, so all our Serbian friends out there will be happy to be able to buy something.
Pretty slick plant.
Yes, it's all brand new over there too and looks great. And this is, again, where Fiat, I think, has stepped up their quality over the last couple of years with some new plants and better facilities to build these things in.
And I want to get back to the luxury market just for a moment, which is the BMW 4 Series. And was there something wrong with the 3?
I guess only the number because they're renumbering. It was the 3 Series. Now it's the 4 Series. The coupe, I believe, is out first, and it will have a couple of engine choices again, like I think it's 240 horse for their turbocharged 2-liter, and then it's about 300 for the 6-cylinder 3-liter that they have. You know, it looks like a 6 Series but shrunk down a little bit, and I don't think that's a bad thing because I think the 6 Series is a very attractive car. So I think that will be a good thing for them. It also has an 8-speed transmission. Which actually we've seen in a few of the Fiats and Chrysler products lately too. What that does is get you better fuel economy, and the shifts are almost unnoticeable in some of these cars now with the automatics. And, you know, I know we've talked about manual transmissions before, and it's fun to drive those. I have one right now on a Challenger here. But the automatics that they've got are so smooth and so easy to drive now that they get better gas mileage than the manuals do. So that's kind of interesting too. But if you're buying a BMW, I suppose you're quite as concerned about the gas mileage and so forth as maybe those of us who might buy the Corolla.
Are they going to have a diesel on this model?
They haven't announced one that I'm aware of, but I certainly think that's a possibility. A turbo diesel in there would make some sense.
Well, thanks, Mark. I look forward to our next drive.
All right. Hopefully it'll be in a 2014.
All right. Take care.
Mark Savage writes about cars for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, plus his own website, and he is editor of American Snowmobiler magazine, published by Waukesha's Kalmbach Publishing. He is also our regular automotive contributor, and he talked with Dan Harmon about the 2014 model year. One last break, and when we return, we'll meet the Milwaukee writer Tom Beal, whose new book is a short story collection called Badlands. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. Landscapes often serve as the inspiration for fiction. Some even have names as evocative as their geology. Wisconsin has its Driftless region, but perhaps no setting has as intriguing a moniker as the rock formations, valleys, and buttes that make up the Badlands. And so when Milwaukee writer Tom Beal set out to write his first book, he found the Badlands of his home state, Montana, were as rich to mine for metaphors as they are literally to mine for dinosaur fossils. The result is the new collection, Badlands. The book consists of short stories, although they are all connected by the same characters and place. Beal tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce why the Badlands were an appropriate setting for his coming-of-age stories.
it was always pretty clear to me that the Badlands had, as you said, sort of a dangerous beauty to them. The book opens up with a kind of a legend that the narrator heard about an amateur paleontologist that goes out into the hills and never comes back as he becomes a prey for a mountain lion, a cougar. And immediately, I think that was, you know, something that struck me, or when I think about of wide open wild spaces like that, is that, you know, there's a power there that we're susceptible to and that we have to be humbled to. And the characters kind of reflect that in their lives. And as beautiful as and wonderful as their childhoods and growing up may be, there is always something not very pleasant or dangerous lurking inside of them, as there may be in most of us. There are just things that we may show on the outside, but inside we have all kinds of capabilities of doing things that may be cruel and harmful and hurtful to others. There's a real roughness in the Badlands, and there's a lot of badness in good people.
All of the stories feature the central protagonist, Matthew Davis. What is Matthew learning as he's looking at these very specific points, these very specific memories?
He's learning a whole lot of things. He's learning, in some ways, he's learning all of the things inside of him that he's not necessarily proud of. He's learning to celebrate his own childhood and his own growing up experience, and he's learning to value his friendships, but he's also looking back at himself and really recognizing that he's done things to people that, you know, are completely against what he knows he should be. You know, he's got badness in him too. So there's beauty in him and in all of his friends. And at the same time, there are those things that are very real, questionable, and that he's not going to deny. You know, he does things to people that he's not proud of, that he doesn't like. And he begins to understand that there's a process to becoming a good person. And I think that's kind of what he's learning along the way. And he also learns that probably one of the most important things in life is to wait, perhaps, for somebody to forgive you. And I think that's part of it, too. And I think along the way, it's being able to forgive himself for various things that happen, you know, throughout the course of the stories. And so at the very end, it's not until the very, very, very end when he's a grown man, when he kind of begins to really accept himself and understand that these things were all part of the course of life. But I think a lot of it is about redemption, forgiveness, and understanding how to be a decent man.
I can see all of us having, you know, these moments where we look back on things we've done and not be proud of. But why explore that in such depth in all of these stories?
To me, it's what makes Matthew human. I mean, in a lot of the incidents that happened to him along the way, you know, they're not necessarily earth-shattering things. They're just things that boys, kids, you know, young men and girls do as they grow up in life. I think he really understands that even sometimes small things can be very hurtful to people, and he seems to be very sensitive to that, and he kind of wants to, you know, reach inside of himself a little bit and deal with it and maybe, you know, offer a bit of an apology to those that may have been harmed along the way. I think in a sense it's a matter of going deeper into the character, and to me, I guess that's where the interest of the story lay.
As a child, Matthew doesn't have this ability to really, you know, or maybe disregards the ability to think through to the end what is going to be the consequence of this action. Yet after the fact, he really is fairly introspective. Is this where it comes from, kind of having that time and distance as a grown man to reflect?
Absolutely. Yeah, he's a shallow SOB is what he calls himself. At various points. And that's not Matthew, the 18-year-old or the 17-year-old or the 16-year-old talking there. That's, you know, that's the 48-year-old man who's, you know, who's looking back and says, you know, I was a shallow SOB, or this was the cruelest thing I ever did to a human being, or I promised I'd never do another cruel thing to a person again as long as I lived. But he realizes that he could never hold up to that promise.
He's also looking back on the friendships he had throughout his childhood and reading about his relationships, especially with his best friend, Idaho Wells. What is so special about that friendship that Matthew and Idaho have?
You know, there's a natural, almost spiritual bond between the two of them. And I think, you know, Matthew often refers to Idaho as the thing that he loves best in the world outside of family. So It's that one step away from family love, really, is a friendship love. And it's a human bond that comes to them very, very naturally. And they share all of the questions of life together. And, you know, they tend to push some boundaries. You know, they kind of go through the paths of life that put them, you know, virtually on the edge of life and death. And I think that in the end, that's probably the bonding, is that they experience life's, you know, ranges, unlike Matthew has any other person to share those things with. So, you know, it's just that natural bonding process that occurs. I think that most people can probably look at a person from their past who may be that person who they love better than anything else in the world outside the family.
Idaho is in many ways the instigator of many of these shenanigans that the boys get into. He does have this kind of violent streak to him, but at the same time, he's also a tremendously forthright and sensitive kid.
Mm-hmm.
How do these two characteristics kind of fight it out within Idaho when he's faced with some of these situations where he should turn back? You know, he maybe wants to, but he doesn't.
You know, not to sound too, you know, esoteric about it or anything, but I guess there's a connection there to the title of the stories, to the Badlands themselves, in which there's a lot of beauty in what is not necessarily apparent, right, to, you know, the initial viewing of things. Idaho, you know, as a kid who does get into a lot of trouble, you know, is very mischievous and precocious, and yet, you know, he's the one who has the much higher moral ability or capability between the two of them. Matthew is more of the, you know, the kid who kind of goes along with things, and I think, you know, Idaho leads him along. But it is Idaho the one who's not afraid to say, you know, I love you, man. I, you know, you're my best friend. I love you. He's not afraid to cry. You know, Idaho is the toughest of the two of them, and he's also the one who's not afraid to cry and show his emotions. So maybe that's kind of what, you know, makes him the tough guy, is that he's tough all the way around, not just tough in terms of a fighter. He's tough with his emotions, and that means he's able to show them without feeling inhibited or judged. He just wears it on his sleeve. So all those emotions, he is what he is, and the goodness in Idaho is just as obvious, I think, as the what might be perceived as the bad. It's not that Idaho's bad. It's just that he gets into trouble a little bit. And he's, you know, he comes from a different background. He's had a rougher life. He comes from a family that's not all together. Matthew doesn't often understand that, because Matthew takes family for granted, isn't able to totally walk around in Idaho's shoes, although he gets it. He understands it. It is a learning process for him along the way. And maybe when you asked me earlier what is it that, you know, that Matthew learns, I think he really learns how to respect Idaho and understand that, you know, not everybody has the same road in life, and it can be more difficult for others.
You write children and the way they perceive the world and situations really well, and I wonder if that comes from being a teacher.
Well, yeah, I think to a certain degree it does. I guess, you know, as a teacher, you're sort of always somewhat stuck in that adolescent mindset to a degree. So although times have changed so much, the kids I'm around today certainly speak an entirely different language than I spoke. But I think at the same time, there's a universal quality to teenagers that will never change. And yeah, so I am connected in that way as a teacher. It does influence that voice, I think, a lot. But it also comes from the fact that if there were experiences in my life or friends in my life, I would go back to that time, to the friends who made the most, you know, indelible impression on me. I would go back to that time period in that place. So that's another reason why I think, as you say, if the voices do resonate, that they're very real for me.
What was the most difficult of these situations that Matthew finds himself in to write?
Oh, the most difficult of them all has got to be called The Flower Devourer. I think that has got to be the most difficult, painful story of them all. And that's simply because, it's at that point where Matthew, I mean, the kid is a normal, you know, everyday, I mean, we'd call him a decent kid, a good kid. but he turns into a bully. And he and Idaho gang up on a young girl, a classmate, whom they don't like. And they don't think that she's not cool. And therefore, they think that for some reason they have the right to belittle her. And they turn into bullies. I mean, this is the same. This is just what, you know, I guess, you know, even as a teacher and always being aware of bullying that happens at school, you know, I almost always want to say to people, it's like, well, first of all, look inside of yourself. I mean, at some point, we probably have done this to other people. What's hard about it is that, to me, there's a section in that story that's very visceral in what they do to her in words. What we would say now, we would probably call it hate speech. You know, it's rough. Anyway, I do not like to read it only because I obviously root for Matthew, and I really see a very kind of verbally violent side that comes out in him there. And therefore, it's very nearly abusive. You know, that's painful for me to read. I think it's an honest story, but I think it was probably the most painful moment for me in the book is when he and Idaho gang up on Monica Rose.
Bullying is such a topical issue right now in our society. Yet what we haven't mentioned is that these stories are actually taking place in the Vietnam era. Mm-hmm. But when I was reading it, I could find so many aspects that resonated, whether it was this us versus them mentality between people who disagreed over the war, or with things like how young people can be so cruel to each other. Were you consciously creating a parallel between what's going on today in our culture?
No, I don't think there was anything about what's going on today in our culture. Certainly, aggressiveness against others is an ongoing thing and will always be there. So that connection between bullying others in 1968 or 1970 in comparison to now is very much the same. So there's very little difference. But that contrast that you talk about, the us versus them, that goes back to, you know, very personal experience. My memories of growing up and being a high school kid at that time period in the Vietnam era, 1968 to 1972, you know, we put ourselves on the side of the anti-war movement. And I did personally. That set us against, I think, kind of the norm of the culture. And so, therefore, there is a bit of an us versus them element in the book because I remember that to me that was a truthful thing, that if you had long hair in those days, at that time period, you were laughed at and scoffed at and mocked and called a girl. For some reason, this was a very difficult thing for men to deal with. They couldn't, you know, it was hard for them to, for some reason, accept boys that looked different than what they were supposed to look like. There certainly were lots of times in my own personal experience when I got really mad and really angry at people that would denounce Martin Luther King and rock and roll music and call anybody who opposed the war a pinko and use all kinds of slanderous terms against Native Americans. And there is a relatively, you know, ignorant side, I think, to society wherever you are. And I think, you know, not that Matthew's better than anybody else, but, you know, I think he was protesting against some of that narrow, what he looked at as narrow-mindedness.
Well, Tom, this is your first book. What was it like going through the process of putting this together?
Well, it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed the whole process. I mean, it was a refuge. It took me a long, long time to do so. But it was nice to have a goal. It was nice to – I think one of the things that I like about it is it's sort of nice to teach literature and then try to do it also and you know, practice what you preach a little bit, put your money where your mouth is. It's definitely a labor of love, and it took me, you know, I guess sometimes I think that if you're going to write, at some point you're going to go back to where you started. You're going to go back to your roots, and that's always been such an important part of my own roots is that place of Montana. And therefore, that part of the process was wonderful, just going back and reliving that time, that town. And the historical time period, I mean, just going back to that, you know, the Vietnam era, that was so informative to me and to my, you know, to my family and my real family, you know. I mean, it was in a very interesting time period. So it was fun just to go back. And, of course, it always gave me something to do in the wee hours of a Saturday night when everybody else was asleep.
Well, Thomas Beale, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about Badlands.
Stephanie, thank you. The pleasure was mine.
Writer Tom Beal is the author of Badlands, a collection of stories. It's his first book. He's a teacher in Milwaukee Public Schools, and he's also a playwright, having written 4 plays. He'll be doing a reading at Boswell Book Company tomorrow night. You can find more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Tom Beal spoke with Stephanie Lecce. So what does dispute resolution in medicine have to do with terrorism and disaster preparedness? On tomorrow's show, a national expert and Milwaukee native talks about the surprising link between those two fields. I'm Mitch Tighe. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. And you know, you can listen back to any of today's segments or segments from previous shows by going to the archive on our website. You can find that 24/7 at WUWM.com/Lake Effect. Thanks again for listening. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.